This podcast is intended for adults and children with adults present to contextualize scientific fisting jokes.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 224, Science Faction Botany.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, is the study of the submissive person in a homosexual relationship, right? A bottom?
That's bottom knee. That is a different science. Heavily done in Toronto. I don't know why, but
bottom city.
We are, of course, going through the different sciences as our new intro bit, and botany is the study of plants, very basically. There are specific sub-disciplines. There are microbotanists. There are people who just study carnivorous trees. There are all these different types of botany.
Do microbotanists work on, like, bonsai trees, and do botanists work on, like, full-size trees?
Yes. In between, there's just, like, a 5'8" guy, perfect sized. It's practiced both in the field and the lab, so there are lab practitioners who literally never leave the lab, and all they're doing is looking at the cellular structures of plants or doing different studies in a lab as to plant growth patterns or nutrient uptake or something like that. And then there are field botanists who go out, and their entire job is to identify plants that are in the field. A lot of times these guys get hired for environmental surveys because you want to go through and make sure there's no endangered plants before you bulldoze a bunch of stuff. So you'll have people on the field side of it and the lab side of it. The field side of it is where a lot more of the jobs are for, like, a lower division biology or botany graduate. They can go in and get a job running around looking for those plants pretty easily. But then as you get a master's or PhD, you usually tend to move up towards the lab work.
So unlike etymology, which we discussed last week.
Entomology. Entomology is the study of words.
Okay. Unlike entomology, which we discussed last week, botany does not lend itself to a Indiana Jones type character.
It does, because you do. You have a guy out in the field. He could be stopping nuclear weapons from coming across the border like
and
that.
Hitting on grad students like crazy.
Like that entomologist we discussed.
I thought entomology was the study of ants, which would make it more like botany, right?
Make it more like botany. Except
Deep Lord of the Rings cut.
Yeah. Much like we talked about entomology, how a lot of famous scientists and researchers, guys like Darwin, had huge entomology habits. They would collect beetles and that kind of stuff. Similarly, a lot of the people from Linnaeus on, a lot of the scientific researchers we know as big names and other things, were amateur botanists as well, and they would do a lot of identification of plants. Similar structure that we've covered before to the Linnaean naming system with the genus and species and that kind of stuff.
Does this include, like, genetic studies, like when they were first doing, like, the
Mendel's
dominant
peas type stuff? Yeah, I mean, those would be botanists slash early geneticists. There is a crossover there. There's still a crossover, obviously, to this day when people are looking at a lot
with
of,
like,
that stuff.
Like, genetically engineering new plants, mostly for food.
Yeah, food or higher tensile strength cotton or something along those lines.
Right.
For shirts that don't stretch.
The field goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks. Not only botany, but there's something called ethnobotany, which is how humans utilize plants. So I've studied ethnobotany of the Kumeyaay people out here in San Diego, how they were able to use things like the creosote bush or the elderberry and what the medicinal uses were. And this goes all the way back to the Greeks. In fact, one of the first instances we have in recorded history of a plant going extinct happens because of Greek ethnobotany. The Greeks had a tiny little plant, which we now use as the example of a heart. When you look at a Valentine's Day heart, that shape, that typical heart shape, is actually reminiscent of a specific plant in the Mediterranean region that was very useful in their ethnobotany practices because
it would help seduce young boys in Greece.
Sort of. It induced abortion. And so it was widespread use throughout Greece because there was no prophylactics or not very good ones. So this plant was so widely used that eventually was used into extinction. They rhino-horned this plant, and now it no longer exists.
Wait, did that happen? Or because this was such an easy means of abortion that it was really easy for anti-abortion activists just to go out there and pick all the plants?
Yeah, they just started burning down the fields of plants.
I imagine that... Was it ethnobotany?
Yes.
Ethnobotany would be a lot of drugs.
Yes, there are a whole bunch of drugs
involved
in it.
Mushrooms,
yes.
Cannabis.
I mean, it just depends where you are. You also have to remember that most places, if you're studying the ethnobotany of every one given place, most places don't have a lot of hallucinogens. In fact,
but most have at least one, right?
Not necessarily. No? It just depends where you are and what the native range is and stuff. So, like, and the ones you would have, like, for instance, here where we currently are, the hallucinogenics that they used is a specific type of Jimson that's incredibly dangerous, and the LD50 dose is very close to the activation dose, meaning you're likely to die when you use it, and also it gives a horrible high. Like, so you, it's not all sweet psilocybin mushrooms, you know?
Like the high is terrible. Like, you have a dream that you're being sodomized by a boar. Like man,
no.
Want some more
it's
wild
worse
boar?
Than that. You get sodomized by a boar. It's no dream.
I'm smoking this boar aphrodisiac.
Yeah. And speaking of boar aphrodisiacs, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing good. I might want some of that boar thing, because I couldn't have been the only one who saw Pumbaa from Timon and Pumbaa and thought, I'd fuck him.
No, you were the only one. Literally.
He was the only one.
Wait, he took the poll. Yeah.
I also saw that as a child. So it was a very advanced and disgusting thought for a child.
That's very true. And with Timon, you went, I could have him if I wanted him.
I don't want a bottom.
Yeah.
Pumbaa's the top.
You're not a bottomiest or whatever.
A botanist.
Yeah. And of course, our scientist of the evening, Bill. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I bought something on Craigslist today and I wasn't murdered. So it's a win. Win-win. Situation.
Wait, did you buy the right to kill somebody? Yeah, because you weren't murdered.
No, I bought a Chinese tea set, actually.
Yeah. Don't drink from it yet.
I feel like that's the reason you weren't murdered. Like, I feel like when you're buying...
Maybe I might still be murdered. It's poisoned.
When you're buying open box ammunition, like, you have more of a chance of getting murdered than Japanese tea set.
How many roses was this tea set?
And of course, if you want to buy your own tea sets, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com. And you can send us a tweet at Faction Science if you have an ungoogleable question for us. And we will have another one of those ungoogleable questions next week. Very excited about that one.
We'd like a little more fan interaction, so if you got an ungoogleable question, or if you think you can stump Bobby, the tyrannical host of this science podcast, then send that question to us at Science Faction.
And by the way, I do like traps. I'm a huge trap fan. So if you want to send one of these and then come back later and be like, ha ha, you missed the right answer. Here you go. I'll be even more impressed. So feel free. Trap me.
If you want to send Bobby some sort of trap, like some sort of box that as soon as he opens it, he's in sort of some sort of cell.
Oh, that'd be great.
You can direct message the show. We'll give you Bobby's address. Yeah. You make his weekend.
Easy enough. All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Article number one, multicellular life much older than we originally thought.
But it looks great.
Yeah, you know? I know. It's been doing yoga. It's not a...
Yeah, it's like Helen Mirren. Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, she's like 70, but, you know, I've slept with uglier old people.
Yeah, I'd Pumbaa her. Not even Slipper or Timon. But,
What is a Simba in this analogy?
You don't want to know,
an innocent boy. Now we're getting back.
Yeah, yeah. It's a kid whose uncle with facial scars has molested them. That's what a Simba is.
It's a Greek tragedy.
So let's briefly go over. We know we have unicellular life and multicellular life. Now, unicellular life can be both prokaryotic, which we've discussed before, or eukaryotic. Prokaryotic is much more simple, doesn't have the same type of cell walls, doesn't have the cell nucleus contained, doesn't have things like mitochondria that help power the cells, separate organelles. It's a much more basic type. And then you can have eukaryotes, some of which are singular cellular life, though they're complex. They have mitochondria, they have a separate nucleus with DNA. Or those things can also be multicellular. So everything that's multicellular is by definition a eukaryote, but not everything that is a eukaryote is necessarily multicellular. The history of life as we currently know it is that life springs up pretty quickly. We have evidence of prokaryotic life at least 3.6 million years ago, billion with a B, but that might also go all the way back to close to 4 billion years ago from an article that we covered just a few months ago.
You said this happens pretty quickly, but you then went on to describe like one third of the universe's lifespan.
No. Well, that's what I mean is it happens pretty quickly after the formation of the Earth. Like the Earth forms at 4 point some odd billion years ago, and pretty quickly, a few hundred million years later, we get life. For sure, but before a billion years.
This is not long after like the Earth was just a pile of magma.
Right. And then you have to remember there was the Theia collision, which is that the way our moon formed is that our planet hit basically another planet. They were in the same orbit. That created a huge tumult that launched a bunch of rocks off that became the moon. That means that, I mean, if you had life before that point, it was almost certainly gone when it hit. So you have a reset button that plays into effect here. And that makes it seem like life started pretty early. However, We haven't had conclusive evidence of multicellular life until about 600 million years ago. This is going to be a little bit before the Cambrian explosion. We have some multicellular life. They're usually soft-bodied. They're doing stuff in the water. Then all of a sudden, we have the Cambrian extinction, and all of those things go away. And then the Cambrian explosion, where multicellular life comes back and radiates really strongly throughout the ecosystem.
Was the Cambrian extinction caused by the Cambrian explosion?
No. No.
That was... it seems like it's a pretty tough speech to survive an explosion.
Right. They must have had to... this is an explosion of life into a whole bunch of different niches. It would be the
like
opposite.
An ejaculation.
Yeah. We'll start calling it the Cambrian ejaculation.
Thank you. It's less confusing to me. To Joe Sixpack over here.
This one particular study indicates the possibility of multicellular life at 1.6 billion, with a B, years ago in China. We think we have something that looks a lot like seaweed. So seaweed, like all plants that we actually see, multicellular eukaryotic life. And it looks like at 1.6 billion years, we have this fossil that looks like a whole bunch of cells making up a single multicellular creature. Now, the caveat, the skeptical people would say,
Are you saying it's the seaweed itself is this example?
Yes.
Or there's something on it?
No, seaweed itself.
Seaweed itself.
The people who are skeptical are saying, I see what you're saying, and you do have a bunch of cells here, and they are fossilized, but maybe this is actually just a mat of single-celled organisms. Now, we know that happens with cyanobacteria and a few other single-celled organisms where they will form together in big clusters and groups. They're all still individual little animals. Like a herd of buffalo doesn't equal one giant Megatron buffalo.
At what point does that distinction become negligible? Like, is it they have different genetics?
Well, those are just a whole bunch of different creatures that happen to be in the same place, you know?
But you could kind of say that about all the cells in it. I mean,
those cells have to, one is an independent organism. You take it apart, it goes and does its own thing. The other thing is a conglomeration of a bunch of stuff. You know,
so the difference is that if you separate them, each of them is still alive.
Yes.
Like a lichen, except only one species.
Well, yeah. And then, so there are things that are very interesting, like slime molds, which are one of the most interesting creatures on Earth. It's actually a whole bunch of single cell creatures that get together to form a Voltron multicellular creature and then crawl around. It forms a slug. So imagine a bunch of bacteria all forming together into a slug and crawling around.
Why don't we have like superhero movies about that?
Yes. The first time I read about a slime mold, I thought to myself, well, one, this is a total lie because I would have heard about this. This would have been on every nature documentary. This is awesome. Turns out it's totally true. Super interesting, and nobody teaches you about it in biology.
If we get enough of these Voltron slimes in one place, would that spell the end of the world?
No, not at all. They're all around us all the time. However, again, this is not talking about slime mold. This is talking about the possibility of an actual multicellular creature, in this case, seaweed, a plant, a multicellular plant. We seem to have those fossils at 1.6 billion years ago. This would be a big deal. It would push that life back. Now, we've had previous examples of, for instance, a potential fossil in Gabon, Africa, that was thought at 2.1 billion years old to be multicellular life. That has since been walked back. They've since said, no,
this... It was
several
cells and a trench coat standing on each other's shelter.
Yes, and they were trying to purchase some low-level pornography, apparently. That's because they had one of those only multicellular life only signs at the front door of the porn shop.
Must have this many cells.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that one kind of got nixed, and it went back to being about 600 million years ago, and this looks like it would add a billion years to that, which is a pretty big deal. Going from 600 million to 1,600,000,000 is a pretty big deal. We'll need to do further follow-up studies. One of the best ways to do this is to look in the same area for future fossils, which can help us distinguish. When you only have a sample of one, it sometimes can be hard to distinguish from those people who say, oh, it's just a bunch of single cells. But if you have multiple fossils, usually you can compare and contrast and be able to tell whether or not that really is.
So if this was the first multicellular life form, was this like the equivalent to all the other species surrounding as like the first redwood tree? Like, look at this massive thing
that nature
has created.
Yeah, it would be thousands and thousands of times larger than anything that had existed. Now, obviously, this wouldn't be the first. This is just the oldest fossil. There were probably stuff around millions of years beforehand, obviously. You had to lead up to it. But this is the oldest examples that we have. Very interesting stuff. Anytime you start elucidating the history of the Earth, it always seems really interesting to me, whether that's figuring out when Homo sapiens first left Africa or figuring out when multicellular life forms first came into existence.
And this study was linking this evolution of eukaryotes to oxygen.
Multicellular life, again, want to distinguish. Because,
right, multicellular life.
Yeah. Right. It was looking at it because one of the problems was they were saying the oxygen levels were too low at this time in Earth's history for us to get this type of life, because this type of life requires significant input. Now, keep in mind, plants are photosynthetic, right? So you might be saying, shouldn't they be talking about CO2? They're basically saying the same thing. What they're saying is you don't have atmospheric density of a high enough amount yet for large forms of life to form. And we know that that there is an issue with oxygen content in the atmosphere and size, because we see later on when plants get really numerous and they produce a whole bunch of oxygen and the Earth becomes inundated with oxygen much more so than it is now, you get these arthropods and stuff that get gigantic. Again, this is like that 600 million year period. Think of like millipedes and centipedes that are 15 feet tall and weigh thousands of pounds. Think of like just crazy stuff because there's so much oxygen. There's some argument too that that's why some of the dinosaurs were so big. You have so much oxygen, it allows you to create a larger animal because you essentially have ramped up the quality of the fuel.
Theoretically then, if I were to raise a child in a high oxygen content bubble,
yes,
could they be Shaquille O'Neal?
Yes, you might be able to get them super big. The only problem is then once they get out of there, it's like when you are like off in the space station and then you get onto Earth's gravity and you feel weighed down. He's going to be huffing and puffing everywhere he goes.
But will they be able to make free throws?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly.
Will he be able to dunk over my other more dweeby son?
Again, I don't know. He might run out of breath real easy. You know, you almost
just need one dunk for a picture.
You're doing the opposite of high altitude training at that point, you know? All right, let's move right on to article number two. They must be southern whales. How one population of orcas have just been discovered to be dramatically inbred.
I'm picturing a whale sitting out on like a sea porch wearing a Make America Great hat, like sees like a black porpoise goes by, keep walking, pulls out a gun.
So these are orcas or killer whales. That is very important because killer whales have a very unique culture in and among themselves. There's also a very interesting thing going on and has been for the past few thousand years where we're seeing what may end up being a speciation event. Right now there's only one species of killer whale or orca, but certain groups of them haven't interbred for thousands of years, and we think that that might eventually end up into a speciation event. The difference is that some of these are what we call resident whales, meaning they live in one area, they usually feed on one type of food source that they become experts at. In the case of the resident whales in New Zealand, they became expert killers of stingrays, and they came up with a really ingenious way to do it. They would grab them by the fin, flip them over. Stingrays are a very primitive form of fish. When they're flipped in that way, they go into this toxic shock where they get paralyzed, and then the whales could eat them without getting stung. They later adapted that technique to great white sharks, and they've been killing great white sharks with that as well.
How many orcas had to be Steve Irwin?
A lot, yeah. And so these are a group of resident whales off the coast of Washington State. This is a big resident population that basically makes its living off salmon. They're expert salmon fishermen. And most of the time in these populations, you have the males grow up to a certain size and they go off and they become essentially freewheeling,
rampant
bachelor
whales.
Yeah, they're bachelor males. They're off doing their thing. They grow into another pod. That's how you get the genetic diversity. In this case, and they think it might be because of their salmon fishing, the males stick with the pod. It's really weird. We think what's going on is their mothers are still teaching them how to catch salmon. They just stay with the pod that they are raised in, which leads to inbreeding. Most specifically, in this case, it has led to two separate males in this pod of 76 whales being the father of half of all of the juvenile whales born between now and 1990. So think of what that means for genetic diversity. It means 50% of all those whales have one of two dads. That is not good.
How many hemophiliac whales do we have right
yeah.
now?
Yeah. One of their cousins went to go rule the New Zealand thing of whales. They just keep bouncing them around. Now, you have to think this is in contrast to the nomadic whale populations, which is the other group of orcas that have been separated from them for thousands of years. These orcas swim up and down. They go up to the Arctic waters to go fish up there. Then they come on down. They move back and forth.
Taunting the inbred whales
that
go by through Washington. Hillbillies.
Salmon, though, is pretty tasty.
Yeah.
You get to just munch on salmon your whole life.
Yeah, but I mean, they look at that as that's the swim over states. It's going right by Florida. So this group of whales has become dramatically inbred. That has led to a huge decrease in the amount of breeding whales within that group. Out of this group of 75 whales, there's only 25 breeding whales, which
and
is
most
really
those
low.
Are from two
yes.
dads.
Yeah.
Which is, like, what is wrong with the other males?
They're probably getting outdominated because these whales grew up in that pod. Normally, you have to go and make your own way by dominating the whale ahead of you,
so
right?
So it's just like the bullies of your class.
Yeah.
I never leave high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, it like went on into the rest of your life.
And just kept banging every girl in your hometown, yeah.
There's like a 40-year-old dude in your English class who just is never going to leave.
And it's because they have this plentiful food supply that they become expert hunters at that they're not leaving, and so they don't have a chance of spreading this beyond it. So this is really sad. There are three pods in this resident whale population. All three of them this applies to. So it's two males have fathered 50% of the calves born between now and 1990 in all three of those.
So wait, one of them is like the secret family pod. Like he leaves like, oh, I'm going on another business trip, spends time with this other pod.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's pulling off. So we have to think about what we're going to end up doing. are we going to have an intervention where we come in with some outside DNA to kind of, you know, add some genetic diversity into that population?
It's like a bigger, sexier whale.
Bring yeah, I'm wondering if you bring in just like a fucking Johnny Depp-esque whale, just hair tossed casually aside.
Can they have mustaches?
They can, but only when they're ready to bang.
You want like a Chris Hemsworth type, because he has to be big enough to fight off all those bully whales.
Yeah. It will be interesting to see if we have to intervene, because, you know, you could make the argument, oh, this is our fault because we've isolated this whale population to the extent that they can no longer breed with some genetic diversity, whatever it is. Or you could just make the case, hey, we've done so much damage, we have kind of some obligation to fix problems, even if we didn't cause them.
Could we save the whales by forcing them to get a new food source, you know, kicking them out of the house, destroy all the salmon?
Okay, so you're saying kind of like the Matthew McConaughey vehicle, failure to launch. We hire a Kate Hudson-esque lady.
Terry Bradshaw's involved somehow.
We get, so in this case, let's take the analogy one step further. We go get Shamu, bring them out to tease the whale with her voluptuous domestic whale mammaries and just bring them out.
SeaWorld whales keep it tight.
Yeah.
These creatures in captivity live much shorter lives than they do in the wild.
Yeah, and they have that issue where their fins kind of go over all sad. They tip over because they're
flaccid.
Not getting exercise. Yeah,
flaccid fin syndrome.
Well, yeah, it's taking this thing that spans, you know, if not dozens, hundreds of miles a day swimming and putting it in what is a glorified bathtub. And then,
This situation reminds me a little bit of like when David Attenborough is like talking about a lion pride and like the young male is growing up. And he's got to be, like, kicked out and go find his own shit. And usually, as a viewer, you're thinking, well, that older lion is just a dick.
Yeah.
But really, he's, like, promoting genetic diversity.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like the talent scout from NBC. Yeah. He's just promoting diversity like crazy.
It seems cruel, but this adult male prevents the Freudian instincts of the younger male from taking over.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, there is that problem. So we'll see how this ends up working out. I think this is one of those things where a lot of people think, we shouldn't intervene with nature. It is what it is. I happen to think we've done so much global damage, it's hard to parse out what we may or may not have affected. And if you have the ability to do good, do it. Go get some artificial insemination. Put some different whale DNA into that group. I don't know, grab a calf, switch it with another calf. Do something to help keep that alive. Because I've seen this particular pod. I've been up to the coast of Washington and see these off the Orca Islands and a couple other places. And they're gorgeous. And it would be really sad for them to suddenly go extinct because of inbreeding.
What if we closed off the Puget Sound? We evicted all the whales from their home, closed off the Puget Sound with a net that was only big enough to fit salmon. They are a large, intelligent, less so since inbreeding, but a large, intelligent creature that can bully it. They can find another food source anywhere.
So you're saying we cut off the salmon?
Yeah, have them go eat polar bears. Polar bears are just easily picked off as they're swimming between icebergs.
All right, let's move right on to everybody's favorite game. I call BS.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
Who is everyone?
Everyone. Literally everybody. Literally. We have an N size of near 7 billion, as we talked about before.
And still only 31 fucking comments on the iTunes page.
Yes, and some of those comments are about how much they love this game. All right, I Call BS is the game where I read 4 science news articles, and my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
Yes, I'm ready. I'm Russell Crowe in Gladiator. Are you not entertained?
All right. Article number 1. The first ever penis and scrotum transplant has been successfully carried out at Johns Hopkins. Damien, is this science or bad science? By the way, just some grammar issues. The first ever has been carried out, at Johns. I'm not saying it's the first one at that hospital. I'm just saying the first one has been carried out. It was at that hospital.
This is bad science. What they don't tell you is that it was needless because all they did was switch a guy's penis and scrotum. This wasn't like to repair
an amputee. They just like turned it 180 degrees?
Like a doctor was like, listen, you got great balls and you got a great dick. Like, maybe we combine these. Okay. I mean, Frankenstein.
Wait, so one of them got both of the good ones and one of them still stuck with both of the bad ones?
They were gamblers. They flipped a coin. They knew the stakes.
Yeah, so now you got like a wrinkly, tiny scrotum.
See, I didn't realize what he was saying. I thought he just meant when he said, I thought he meant they put the dick where the balls were. And
By the way, also, like the guy who has great balls, like is there an award for that? That seems like an award nobody would want to give or judge.
Hold on a second. I'm just thinking about something. balls on top would be a huge advantage. Huge advantage.
Practically?
I mean, yeah. You're not getting kicked in the balls nearly as much because they're like up top. You're not going to pee on your balls. They're not going to be dangling down into the actual toilet if you're sitting down. All of this is great.
With CRISPR technology, we could fix this.
You know what? Hey, God. We've beaten you. we've beaten your design.
They would like rest on the dick the whole time. They'd get warm, right?
That's Think of why. It. You know how like a... You know those sheep that ram heads? You know how they have those like kind of curved horns that come droop down over their head?
Exactly.
It would look like that. Only don't ram them. Don't. That'll just be painful.
No. It'll take some getting used to, but I could see the advantages.
All right. And Bill.
Where was the science in all of this?
First ever penis and scrotum transplant.
I'm going to say this is science because there was like a report of someone transplanting a head like a year ago, so dick seems like
it seems easy, play. Right? Yeah. All right, on to article number two. Ultrasounds may be obsolete as a new test can tell a baby's gender from a simple blood sample from the mother in the first trimester. Damien, is this science or bad science?
I don't really have a specific answer. I have a general answer that maybe you'll take. I'm going to say it's bad science because maize.
God damn it. All right. And Bill.
I will say that this is science because I work in a building with the nano engineering department, and they've discovered a lot of ways to pick out very small concentrations of things in your blood using nanotechnology. So like basically higher surface area for detecting small amounts of things in your blood, and this may be one of those things.
So what's weird to me is that you work next to the nano department?
In the same building.
As the nano engineering?
Yeah.
Which is weird, because I thought they discontinued the iPod Nano a long time ago. And it wasn't that great a thing in the beginning anyway. Like a whole engineering department at the university just for that?
We have them on our phones now.
Yeah. Come on, Apple. Let's go. All right. Article number three. A new study from Scandinavia has found that some people are getting their UTIs from their pets. Naming is a science... Or bad science. By the way, for those of you guys out there who don't know, UTI, urinary tract infection.
This is science, but to be fair, Scandinavia has some very fuckable animals. I mean, take a look at the Norwegian fucking beagle.
Ironically, that's the one that they don't fuck. That's just it's a total misnomer. It's like Iceland and Greenland. One's green and one's, you know, it's one of those
things. One beagle is fuckable, the other is not.
The Norwegian fucking beagle is actually the one that's totally celibate. You can't have sex with. However, the Danish prude beagle? Oh, man.
Eric the Red didn't want foreigners coming and fucking all their animals.
Yeah, it's got eight nipples and all of them are hard. All right. And Bill.
I'm going to say science because I know that having a pet... It influences the microbiome of the people that it lives with. And since UTIs are, in some cases, bacterial, it makes sense that there might be an interplay there.
Very interesting. Article number four. A 13-foot-tall wooden statue of a human found in Indonesia has been accurately dated to 11,600 years ago. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. It actually was an Indonesian statue of a woman shooting ping pong balls out of her vagina.
Okay. It's not even, it's Thailand.
It's cultural.
Yeah, I don't even, get your racism straight, for God's sakes.
Indonesia, Jakarta, have more stereotypes.
All right, and Bill.
I'm going to go with science just so that I can go, like, shoot the moon, like everything being science.
It looks like a ping pong ball.
Yeah, with no other reason than that. I don't know anything about wooden statues.
Fair enough. Let's go see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number one. The first ever penis and scrotum transplant has been successfully carried out at Johns Hopkins. Damien thinks this is false. Bill thinks this is true. And this one is science. They had previously done two successful dong transplants, but this one was the first one that also took the scrotum, though they didn't take the testicles because they didn't want this guy impregnating somebody with a different person's semen.
So wait, they just took the skin off? They just took the body off the car with the engine and frame was still there?
They might have. There's something for dogs called neuticles, which are fake testicles. They're implants that they put in so that after you get your dog neutered, then you don't have to feel like your dog feels inadequate at the dog park. I don't know if maybe they put neuticles in there.
Wait, are these like plastic ball-looking implants?
I mean, they're
implants?
Not nearly as basic as that. I'm sure they're made out of some kind of silicone composite, but yes.
So we got a dick transplant, but no testicles. So essentially he's neutered. He talks three octaves higher.
He was a war veteran. He had lost his junk in an IED explosion. So they did this transplant. Again, previous transplants. They've done two previous ones of just the dong. This one was dong and scrotum. And by the way, that upper area above the dick where like the skin, like the Brad Pitt V area, you know, they did all of that and it was successful. They think not only will he be able to urinate, but function sexually with it. It took a lot of, it's a lot of connections of nerves, of veins, of arteries, of all this type of stuff. They seem to do it. We're going to see how it goes, but that is a huge bonus to all those people.
He's going to have to report back with scientific evidence about how his orgasms are.
100%.
Like, high fives, the scientist the whole time.
Bill, and then Bill, I got you one step further. His wife is going to have to report whether or not she's as sexually satisfied.
Oh, yeah. Does he get
now,
as hard as he used to?
I think we should increase the N number. See if, you know, I can get hard for more than one woman, bro. I mean,
for science.
Yeah, I thought you loved me.
But you got to think, okay, obviously this is great for these people who need it. They had horrible accidents. I wish you all the luck. That's fantastic. How long before somebody's like, I need an upgrade? You know, like everything's working, but, you know, the fake breast industry didn't just start with people wanting bigger tits. It started with mastectomies that left women without breasts. Then people developed fake breasts.
Like exactly analogous.
Yeah.
We're going to create a black market for the huge dong.
And like the black market name is very accurate because where they're going to be looking.
Oh, it's going to ruin the NBA. The NBA is just going to be whites and Asians.
Article number two, ultrasounds may be obsolete as a new test can tell a baby's gender from a simple blood sample from the mother in the first trimester. Damien thinks this is false. Bill thinks this is true. And this one is science. And it's very important for a reason that I will get into. Right now, the way we check the baby's gender is you can either do an amniocentesis, which is very dangerous. That's actually taking a blood sample from inside the sac that the baby's in. So you have to put a needle through the mom's stomach into that sac, take it. That can be lethal for a baby. They only let you do that if there's a question about some really serious genetic defects.
And now, when you say sac, that's not, we're not going back to the last
article.
No.
Yeah. And there's testicles in that sac. They're small, but they're there.
Undescended.
So that's one way, or two is the ultrasound, which we all know about. You know, every doctor's office has an ultrasound. We see it all the time.
One of these involves lube, the other does not.
Yes, exactly. The thing about ultrasound that most people don't realize and they don't advertise, no clinical testing ever for the ultrasounds we currently use. The reason for that is ultrasound came out in the 80s and 90s as a method of looking at babies in utero. At that point, it was investigated by the FDA. They went through clinical trials and they said, okay, this looks safe. Since then, how much more powerful do you think the ultrasound is now than the stuff we used in the 90s?
As in, like, how much of the baby can we see now?
No. The signal that we're sending into the uterus, is it 50% stronger?
200% stronger.
10 times stronger.
Wow.
So we
turned it up to 11.
Yeah.
That ultrasound.
We are just irradiating these babies with ultrasonic noise the entire time. It is dramatic. This has never been tested for safety. And not only that, but as we covered an article about 2 years ago on Science Faction, there's more and more evidence coming in every year that this might be detrimental. The one we covered had to do with the severity of autistic symptoms in fetuses already predisposed to autism through from a genetic basis. And we saw that if you had ultrasound done before the 11-week mark, that your chances of that autism manifesting much more severely were dramatically higher.
So they haven't done tests for like this frequency of radiation at this amplitude. Like what effects does it have?
Absolutely. They have not done it.
That's insane.
That is totally insane. Not enough people are talking about it. It is not coming back around. We've covered three or four different articles about the negative effects. There's also other known negative effects, including the fact that it disturbs the fetus. It's rolling around. This actually changed my mind so much that when my wife got pregnant, I would not allow the OBGYN to do the ultrasound before 11 weeks. And let me tell you, they're pissed about it. Like if you bring this up and you're like, actually, according to the research that was published like 2 months ago, and she's like, screw that. We've been doing this forever.
Right. Yeah. But who knows what the effects are.
Exactly.
Could you negate this if you somehow were to get a composer to compose an ultrasound, like Mozart in ultrasound to the baby?
That's right, because of course, Mozart makes your kid a genius, of course.
Something, TED Talks if you fucking want.
Something to think about, this ultrasound thing has kind of snuck through the cracks. I equate it very similar to the herbal medicine loophole that lets people market medicines without going through FDA trials just by calling them herbs or vitamins, and so therefore they're not regulated. And sometimes we have now seen that some of those are carcinogenic, strongly so, or they're really bad for you in other ways, and they're not being tested, but people think I'm buying them in a store, it must be safe. People think I'm getting this in a doctor's office, it's totally used all the time, it must be safe. We do not know that it's safe.
It would be like that if herbal supplements also worked.
Yeah. What's crazy to me is this is something we've seen cause problems that we have no evidence doesn't cause problems. It's never gone through proper testing. Nobody talks about it. Vaccines are super safe. We have a bunch of evidence, the largest end sample of any large scientific study ever conducted, and people go against vaccines. Why is it that the one thing that might actually be causing damage nobody cares about?
But it also, like, it doesn't seem like it provides that much benefit.
It doesn't.
Vaccines are obviously useful, yes. But like getting a picture of your baby before it's in the world is like...
It does have some benefits in that it can help tell if there's some malformations, if there are particular genetic defects. However, these new blood tests, which are able to, like Bill said, pull out really small amounts of the trace stuff that's within the mom's blood, in this case, the Y chromosome or not, having a Y chromosome or not, can also start to do that too. So once we get to a point where we can do this with other means, we shouldn't have these in the doctor's office.
I'm picturing a couple recently realizing their son has autism, and by this time it's common knowledge that ultrasound does this, and you know, sweetie, we had to know which way to decorate the room.
Yeah.
We needed to know that.
I'm not painting that thing yellow. Article number 3, a new study from Scandinavia has found that some people are getting their UTIs from their pets. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science. Indeed, a UTI, like we just talked about, was bacteria getting into your bladder. Tends to happen to women much more. That's just a fact of physiology. Men tend to have longer urethras because of the penis, and so it keeps the bacteria further away, and therefore they don't get the UTIs as much. Researchers took samples of people who had UTIs, and then they went and they took samples of their pets, and they found in the poo of their pets, some of them had the overlapping exact same bacteria within the pet poo.
Did they find the peanut butter?
And within the people. Now, that means that they came from the same place. Now, you could make the argument, maybe the person gave the bacteria to the pet. Maybe it went from the other way. So what they did is they did follow-up studies 10 months later where they went back and tested both the person and the pet. Now, obviously, the person's UTI had cleared up by then. Otherwise, they would be in the doctor for some other stuff. But the pet still seemed to show the exact same bacteria, meaning that it's likely a constant endemic infection within those pets, and that somehow, at some point, it got transferred over to that owner. Now, I'm not saying people are like horse riding their dogs naked or like doing some weird sex stuff. That dog could be up on the couch hanging out, then you get up on there later wearing shorts.
Yeah,
who knows?
You pet your dog, or like, you know, your dog smells your crotch,
yeah,
which is like
absolutely
unavoidable, then it transfers bacteria.
Yeah, I mean, like, and no matter how hard your dog pulls away, you're still forcing it to smell your crotch. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a scenario we all...
And article number 4, a 13-foot-tall wooden statue of a human found in Indonesia has been accurately dated to 11,600 years ago. Damien thinks this is false. Bill thinks this is true. And this one is bad science, meaning, Bill, you are our winner. Congratulations, sir.
Hooray.
You have dominated Damien once again, throttling him.
Can you admit that, like, you hate it a little bit more when he wins and it's not a tie? Because, like, the tie hurts me more.
I don't even know that you've ever tied.
From a fairness standpoint.
Have you ever tied before? I don't even think you've gotten to a tie.
Once or twice, you son of a bitch.
So this 13-foot-tall wooden statue was actually found in Siberia at the end of the 19th century. It was just now carbon dated to that date. People who didn't believe it when the first dates were coming back, many thousands of years old, they said there's a wooden statue. There's no way it can survive. And here was your clue. If it had been Indonesia, there would be no way it could survive, because in tropical elements like that, wood has a half-life that is very short. You're lucky to find a piece of wood that lasts more than 150 years in a tropical environment.
Those Russians are strong.
Yes, yes. However, in Siberia, which is essentially a frigid desert in most of the parts because of its precipitation levels, you can have wood that apparently lasts for literally 11,500 years. Very interesting statue. It's a very humanoid statue with interesting crossed legs, 13 feet tall. And you might say, what culture is this? We don't fucking know. It was 11,500. This is before the Agricultural Revolution. This is when nomadic hunter-gatherer groups are running around. And by the way, while it's after their extinction, this is still in the area of the Denisovans. So these people had some Denisovan DNA mixed in, some Neanderthal DNA. These are wild, primitive times with wild, primitive people who are creating these large humanoid sculptures. Who knows why? Maybe it was worship. Maybe it was religion. Maybe it was a fertility ritual. Maybe they just thought it looked cool. The same reason we do statues, you know?
Do we know if they preserved it in some way with like wax?
It was at the bottom of a bog, which is usually anaerobic.
Oh,
and,
I see.
But we don't know if that was purposely put in there, if that just happened to end up in there.
I was thinking like, you know, a layer of varnish.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Borland was back.
High layer gloss.
Well, they could.
You know?
What if they like, you know, cut down a beehive and then melted it onto the top of the head? Because that's weird.
Yeah, right.
This like having tons of our villagers die from bee stings was worth this statue.
All right, let's move right on to Damien Channels a Dead Scientist.
And now, Damien Channels a Dead Scientist.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
Hello, true believers, and welcome back to Damien Channels a Dead Scientist. Bobby and big government did all they could to shut us down, but now we're back to share the truth. I'm going to get set up. Bobby, do you care to explain the bit while I get ready to channel some spirits?
Damien pretends he has some kind of supernatural ability to have a scientist inhabit his body. He flops around a little bit, says the word spirits, then he pretends to be them while we point out the inconsistencies in his story, and then we finish with a oddly unfulfilling reveal of the fact that Damien's been lying.
Let's meet in the middle and say I channel a dead scientist.
Okay,
I got all the candles lit. Bill, if you might turn down the lights just a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Okay, Bill, have you seen me channel a dead scientist before?
I think I've been promised and then not delivered several times.
Oh, well, tell you what, Bill, you judge for yourself.
I will.
Let's get this started. Ooh, spirits.
Notice how he says spirits. Channel the spirits.
Yeah.
Bonjour, bonjour. It is I, acclaimed physician and scientist, Klaus Bernhard. Ah, how wonderful it is to be back in Midgard. Ah, it is wonderful. Oh, and to be summoned by my favorite science comedy podcast. I've been listening to Skeptic's Guide for years. And let me just say, Robert Novella, you are much less attractive in person than I in your
this
voice.
This is not Skeptic's Guide. This is actually Science Faction.
Oh, this is, I listen to Science Faction too, however, I would listen more, but as a doctor, I cannot support the cruelty and tyrannical host Bobby and his sick game of I Call BS. I do, however, find humor in the character work from the show's protagonist, Damien, and I find him to be, how you say, quite delightful.
I don't know what's more offensive, all the horrible jokes we've said on this podcast, Damien's French accent, or the statement that somebody would love Damien's performance on this show.
I am not normally of fans of joking of Le Dick, but Le Dick joke, but Damien's Le Dick joke, he's an artist who paints a picture in dicks. But I assume everybody knows of the famous physician Claude Bernard.
No, nobody knows who you are now.
Nobody knows who... Damn American barbecue
Actually,
people.
Your home province is more famous than you, I think. Could you teach me how to pronounce the name of your home province?
Lyon?
No, I think that's north.
North Lyon?
There's a special wine from that province.
Well, I was born in 1813 in the village of Saint-Julien near Villefranche, near Saint-Romain.
You know, okay. The last part was just noises.
the American ear is not sophisticated.
Yeah, as much as I know about French, that's correct.
Thank you, William.
All right, well, what'd you do, Claude?
Well, I am known for many things. For example, I was the first to define the term milieu intérieur, which was later renamed homeostasis. It was an idea that became homeostasis. Though I clearly an American barbecue person came up with the name because it is so much less poetic than milieu intérieur. I was the first to suggest the use of, blind experiments. Before me, doctors and scientists' experiments were saturated with bias. We were not, unlike Monsieur Robert Timothy and his archaeology. I was also the first doctor to employ the scientific method. Before me, all doctors were little more than well-dressed shaman. Because of me, all of the quacks left the medical field and, of course, found their way into archaeology and homeopathy and other such lesser sciences.
All right. So the way this works now, Bill, is we ask him questions that prove that he's not who he has claimed to be. If you would like, I have a question that he can answer, I can ask, or if you'd like to go first.
I also have some prepared.
Yeah, go for it.
So I was wondering if you could explain to me your work on the pancreas.
Yes. I was the first to discover the glycogenic function. No, as I was of the liver, I discovered the glycogenic function of liver. I was the first to discover the purpose of the pancreas, and it was to kill Patrick Swayze. He's up in heaven ripping throats like crazy now.
Oh, man, this is actually a story. Check it out.
Any more questions for Claude Bernard?
Yeah, okay, I got one. So you were one of the fathers of the idea of blinding experiments, right?
Yes, French orphans were very easy to come by, and he had an almost limitless in number of blinded orphans at the time.
So a blinded experiment is when the subject is unaware of whether or not they're getting treatment or placebo. A double-blinded experiment is where both the subject and the administrating doctor are unaware of whether they're getting activation or placebo. Please, Mr. Expert on Blinding, explain what a triple-blinded experiment would be.
If you're asking me to come up with ways of experimenting that have been invented after my death...
But yeah, you keep up with that stuff, as you've pointed out. It's like you keep up with our podcast.
I listen to your podcast. I watch HBO Go up in the afterlife. You know this. This is canon in the I Call Damien.
What you're saying, Mr. Claude Bernard, who invented blinding, you don't know what triple blinding is.
It is when you have a independent third party interpret the results from the study.
Wow, that's actually right. Good job.
Claude Bernard came.
I think I have maybe a doozy. What is the name of the five-act play that you wrote before you became a scientist?
Ha-ha! You got him, Bill!
Him! I forgot because it received such harsh criticism. Boom. I burned it, but I was once a very prominent vaudeville French comedian.
All right, Bill got him. Boom! Get out of here, Damien.
I'm going to triple blind both of you.
Either he's not really Claude, or he's been watching too much HBO in the afterlife.
All right.
Silicon Valley, is anybody following? All right, au revoir, au revoir. I'm off to go to Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Why do I feel like eating frog legs? Which scientist was it this time?
If eating frog legs is a euphemism for lying and getting caught, then you absolutely did it. All right, thank you, Bill, for coming back for 224, and thank you, audience, for coming back, where you learned about botany. How multicellular life might be much older than previously thought. How we got a whole group of inbred whales off the coast of Washington. How we did the first ever penis and scrotum transplant. How we might be able to tell a baby's gender from the mom's blood. Why a bunch of Scandinavians are getting UTIs from their dogs. And how an ancient wooden statue survived for 11,500 years in Siberia. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 225.
There is actually a 12,000-year-old French statue of a man being rude to an American.
You've been listening to Science Function. Wait, that's not right.